This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Coming up this half hour, with the latest outbreak of African swine fever less than 700 kilometres away from Australia, what will happen if it reaches here?
You're not going to be processing any animals for around 96 hours, which means we instantly have an 80,000 pig backlog across the country. That is a lot of catching up to do.
And adding to the pork industry's concerns about the Timor outbreak is the news that the Darwin International Airport does not have a working sniffer dog. The industry is calling for a no-compromise approach to biosecurity. Also today, we're going to look at the stars to see what benefits space technology has for farmers on the ground here on Earth. And we're going to hear all the details about the latest in satellite research. But before then, today we start with the federal government's drought funding, particularly the $1 million it's allocated to councils. You'll recall that for South Australia, that's the Coorong District Council and the York Peninsula Council. Well, a forensic audit of the system that allowed a Victorian shire experiencing one of its best springs in a decade to be chosen for a $1 million drought grant has found it is still eligible. The Moyne Shire Council in the southwest of Victoria will meet today and is expected to decline the grant announced by the Prime Minister on Friday. Yesterday, when questioned about why the region, where farmers are experiencing good seasonal conditions, was chosen as one of 13 councils to receive the grant, Drought Minister David Littleproud ordered a forensic review of the Bureau's data. This morning, there was no word from the Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, whose infrastructure department administers the grants. But a tweet by the Department of Infrastructure, Transport, Cities and Regional Development said it had rerun the data for the Drought Communities Program, which confirms the 13 local government areas announced on Friday are eligible. So that includes that Victorian Shire, and it also includes the Coorong and York Peninsula councils. Well, the federal opposition is questioning where some of the allocated drought funding is going. Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon spoke to Michael Condon about his concerns over where the funding is and isn't going.
Look, this is a terrible outcome. You know, we were all hopeful that when Scott Morrison made his latest announcement on Friday regarding the drought, that finally something meaningful would be done. But this again was modest, piecemeal and ad hoc. And, you know, obviously we can't believe it when they're declaring somewhere like Moyne Shire in drought, when the mayor down there is saying, hey, we don't need this money, please give it to somewhere else. And yet, you know, townships like Singleton in my own electorate, or a number of townships in the electorate of Edmund Air are missing out when they are clearly impacted by drought. So something's going terribly wrong here.
Well, no additional money for areas like Pooncarry or Walgett or Wilcannia. There was no additional help for Merriwar and Murrurundi, places like that where they're on level 6 water restrictions, you know, less than 3 minutes of showers and things like that. No extra help for those communities that have been in drought for a long, long time.
And this is why we need the release of the Drought Coordinator's Report. I mean, Major General Stephen Day was recruited to do really important work, to develop a battle plan, to analyse current programs to see how effective they were, to recommend how we might do things better. And we welcome that, because the government had abolished the COAG reform process, so I thought we might have been just getting back on track with him. But I think it was just the uniform they wanted, not anything meaningful. They're refusing to release that report from Major General.
And he says he's handed it in. He's quite happy for it to be released as well.
Oh, no doubt. Yep. No doubt. And I suspect the government refuses to release it because he's done his job properly and he's been critical of the inadequate nature of current programs and the lack of strategic direction in drought policy in this country. The other thing that has to happen is that Scott Morrison needs to be be honest with the Australian community. He continues to run around saying they are spending $7 billion on drought programs. Now, this is patently untrue. I don't know who he thinks he's kidding. Farmers and rural communities know it's untrue. They're not receiving any of these monies. I think his target audience are those in the cities and in the suburbs who expect a Prime Minister, a government, to do something for these drought-affected communities.
Now, we're also hearing, in fact, the Federal Water Minister, David Littleproud, was saying we're actually blaming the Bureau of Meteorology. He was talking about using those figures to determine the areas that were in drought and might have needed assistance. Let's hear a little bit of what he said on RN.
With due respect, there's a methodology that's put in place that's predicated off the Bureau of Meteorology. They drought map each shire. And as at the 30th of June, according to the Bureau of Meteorology, 62% of that shire was in drought. That triggered, along with 12 other shires who were also in drought, our response, which the Prime Minister announced on Friday, to provide them with a stimulus, a $1 million stimulus to help build those communities.
So that's the Federal Water Minister, David Littleproud, laying the blame with the Bureau. Your thoughts on that, Mr Fitzgibbon?
It's always someone else's fault, isn't it, Michael? I mean, they said they were taking responsibility for building dams, and they talked about it incessantly for 6 years and didn't turn a sod of soil, let alone build a dam, and now it's all the state government's fault. It's the responsibility of the states, they now say. But instead of going blaming the Bureau, let's just have a bit of common sense. David Littleproud should just come to my electorate and, you know, drive from Jerry's Plains to Denman, two small towns very close together, and tell me why one should be included in the drought declarations and one should not. Now, he'd only also have to go to the DPI website in New South Wales to confirm that Singleton is drought affected, or talk to the mayor of Singleton, who will tell you that consumption is down in their town because of the impact of the drought on her farmers. But one last point. They won't give us this model. They won't give us this model, they say, this robust model they say they rely upon. But can I now conclude that Singleton will be included if he's going to revisit having this so-called forensic audit? I hope springs eternal for me.
That is Shadow Agriculture Minister Joel Fitzgibbon speaking there to Michael Condon, and the ABC has also contacted the Bureau of Meteorology for comment. 0467 922 783 if you'd like to have your say on any of today's topics. Staying on this, though, as part of the federal government's drought package, money is also going towards rural financial counselling. The government will provide $740,000 to five rural financial counselling service providers nationally. Paula Kelly is the Senior Rural Financial Counsellor with Rural Business Support and joins us now. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Paula, how much funding are you getting from the government and how many extra counsellors does that mean for South Australia?
The recent federal government funding announcement has been welcomed by us at Rural Business Support, and we will be able to add two additional rural financial counsellors and a rural financial counselling service support officer to our staff, which we're really, really pleased to hear about.
And, I mean, what demand is there for your services at the moment?
Over the last 12 months, we've seen an enormous increase in that demand, and our numbers have more than doubled over that period of time. While the frantic pace of that workload has kind of evened out a little bit, we are still seeing an increase in inquiry from those dry areas in the state at the moment.
And so how many farmers are you helping at the moment?
Currently working with more than 500 farming families.
And to put that into perspective from last year?
At July last year, we were sitting at about 245 farming families.
So your demand has more than doubled. I mean, what are the inquiries around?
The inquiries are around how to manage your business through challenging times, both from a cash flow point of view, a longer term viability point of view, and bank negotiation point of view for ongoing finance.
The federal government has announced it's making changes to the farm household allowance, and that was part of its announcement on Friday. What exactly is changing?
Farm Household Allowance announcements refer to an increase in the off-farm income offset threshold and also an easier application process, both of which should mean that more people are able to access that assistance.
What exactly is going to be made easier? Like, how will the process be changing?
We don't have a lot of information on how the application process is changing yet. We hope to hear more about that in the next few days or weeks. The off-farm income offset for those people that work off-farm as one of the measures for creating or becoming a more sustainable business or create or increasing their viability over the longer term, that off-farm income offset calculation is not easy to explain quickly, but it does mean that you are able to earn income off-farm that won't have, there'll be a portion of that that will be excluded from the eligibility criteria. So not 100% of your off-farm income is necessarily going to be assessed as off-farm income.
Last year they had national roadshow getting feedback on the Farm Household Allowance. In your experience, what are the main concerns from farmers in South Australia who are trying to access that and maybe have been put off?
The complexity of the application process, definitely. We were able to have some input into the Farm Household Allowance review earlier in the year and last year. The complexity of the application process is something that does put people off. It is also something that we can help our clients with as rural financial counsellors.
And some rural financial counsellors have done training in mental health or mental health first aid and that sort of thing. Is this happening in South Australia?
Yes. We've recently completed some further mental health training on the Eyre Peninsula about 3 weeks ago.
And we are heading into summer, and already, I mean, we've had forecasts in the high 30s or even 40 for some parts later this week. How do you anticipate the demand for your services to sort of change as we now head into summer?
We expect, as those people that are looking at some bank contact in the coming months, we expect to see an increase as a result of that interaction. For those that have little to reap, we expect to hear from them sooner. Those that are reaping, we'll perhaps hear from them a little later in the year. Short story though, we expect to see an increase in numbers. The recent rain received was beneficial for some people, a little late for some people. We also expect to see an increase in inquiry from those experiencing their third and fourth dry year, and also an increase in the workload for our current clients that are experiencing their third and fourth dry year.
So these two new counsellors, they're coming just at the right time.
They are. We're very pleased.
Okay, Paula, thanks for your time in the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
That's Paula Kelly, who is the Senior Rural Financial Counsellor with Rural Business Support. And as you've heard, the government is spending $740,000 nationally for those service providers, and that will mean two new positions for South Australia. It is 18 past 12 on the Country Hour, and we're going to stay with the drought because an ecologist is worried that the drought is becoming so severe. He's worried the long-term survival of some native animals. Harold Eamon says because of climate change and drought, some species, particularly frogs in the Flinders Ranges, may struggle to recover from the drought or even be put on the path to extinction. Mr. Eamon says while drought is a natural part of Australia's landscape, the severity of this one stands out.
It's the depth of the drought that's the issue. It's not out of the ordinary for species to reduce in number, and it's probably not out of the ordinary for some locations where they did occur for them to be no longer there. But it's when the number of locations where they're not at becomes numerous, and when they're no longer found over vast tracts of where they were found before, that's when it becomes an issue. Yeah.
So what issue actually arises from that?
Well, for a start, they're going. They're on the slide to extinction.
And do you think? You mentioned frogs before, but do you think that some of these species in the arid lands are going to go extinct explicitly because of drought?
Well, it's not just the drought; it's also climate change. the degree of the drought is related to the increasing variation in weather patterns that we're seeing with climate change. We're getting drier, drier and longer dry summers. We will also get some higher wet periods, but they'll be punctuated. There'll be punctuations essentially in a hotter, drier condition. So, yeah, we're looking at declines, and that's what this climate change is doing, and that's why this drought, which is, drought is a normal thing, but when it's overlain by increases in extremes, then it becomes an extincting event.
There are many pastoralists who might disagree with what with the sentiment that maybe kangaroos or other species like them are exactly on the decline, since they're probably seeing a lot more of them at the moment, and in some cases probably shooting them to try and preserve pasture for their own stock. Do you have any what role do you think pastoralists are playing in the ecosystem at the moment?
Well, when it comes to kangaroos, large kangaroos like reds and greys and euros, the pastoralists are absolutely right. Their numbers have massively increased since pastoralism came. They're a super abundant native species, and they're having massive detrimental impact. Something needs to be done to reduce their numbers. Sure, there'll be lots of them that are dying, but the point is that they're coming from a very high population number to start with. The large kangaroos have benefited very substantially from pastoralism, because of the placement of lots and lots of waters. So they don't really need to get access the water from the food that they used to have to do before. They've also benefited because there's no longer an original Australians hunting pressure on them at watering points that used to be very much fewer. And there are no more dingoes. So the large kangaroos have done incredibly well, and I'm not at all surprised that pastoralists need to do something about reducing their numbers.
That's ecologist Harold Eamon speaking there to Lucas Forbes.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 22 past 12. Well, Australia would be left dealing with an instant backlog of 80,000 pigs should the deadly African swine fever be detected in the Northern Territory. That's according to the country's biggest pork producer. SunPork says it's taking a proactive lead in developing contingency plans following the detection of the disease in East Timor, just 700 kilometres north of Darwin, and it's calling for a no-compromise approach to biosecurity. Managing Director and CEO Robert van Barneveld says he's extremely concerned about the threat posed to the Australian industry.
From an Australian perspective, what it highlights is our absolute imperative to keep it out from a biosecurity perspective and elevate our biosecurity. What you are seeing is what can happen when you have very poor biosecurity. And in places like East Timor, they trade pigs. It's almost a currency. So when you have unrestricted and uncontrolled movements, this is what happens.
Concerns have been raised about biosecurity at Darwin Airport. Apparently there is no working sniffer dog there. There's also very close links between people in Darwin and Southeast Asia. Do you think that's a particular weak spot?
I think it is a weak spot, and the thing that concerns me in particular is there doesn't seem to be clarity around if you did have a confirmed case in a feral pig or in a northern part of Australia, it shuts the whole country down. There's no discrimination there. So in theory, you can't move a domestic pig for 72 hours while they decide the next steps. Now, that alone has a massive impact on the industry.
What would happen if they did discover an outbreak in the Northern Territory? What would happen to your operation in the immediate sense?
It would happen to everybody's operation, but we would basically defer to the AusVet plan, and the governments would adopt procedures under emergency exotic animal disease incursions. And one of the first things that happens is that animals stop moving, rightly so that they can identify where the disease is and what its risk of spreading is and how that can be contained in the first instance. But for the pork industry, we can't just leave pigs in a paddock. They have to keep moving. So if you have a minimum 72 hours stand down, you're not going to be processing any animals for around 96 hours, which means we instantly have an 80,000 pig backlog across the country. That is a lot of catching up to do.
Has there been any clarification on how that would be dealt with?
We are working as a company very hard to take a proactive lead on this. We're meeting with Australian Pork Limited this week, and depending on how they will respond, that'll dictate how we take things forward in our own right. But we're very interested in working as closely as we can with the authorities and state government and federal government, so we do have clarity and we understand what the process is and what we have to put in place if there is an outbreak. But having said that, control is going to be far more difficult, in my view, than keeping it out. So where we should be ramping up our efforts is in biosecurity and making sure there are no weak spots.
To that end, what are you and others in the industry calling for in terms of stepped up biosecurity?
There can be no compromise. As an industry, we've always protected our borders. We don't import any genetics into this country because we do not want to see any of these exotic diseases in Australia. So you could argue that as an industry, we have contained our progress to some extent because biosecurity is so important. Now we need the rest of the country to understand what the consequences are. And, you know, should one of these exotic diseases, be it African swine fever or foot and mouth disease, get into Australia, I don't believe anybody truly appreciates the consequences for everyday living.
Outline what they are.
It's just restrictions on access to food. We're not going to be able to move animals. We're going to have difficulty processing animals. We're going to have issues with disposal of animals. That's a reality if these diseases get into the country. Just pure logistics of movement of food. So, the best thing we can do is keep these diseases out of the country, and there can't be any compromise on our biosecurity.
That's SunPork CEO Robert van Barneveld speaking there with Jody Gunders. And SunPork is one of the largest piggeries in the country, and it does have an operation here in South Australia at Worsley's in the mid-north. Staying on this topic, and the head of Australian Pork Limited agrees it's alarming to hear that the Darwin International Airport does not have a working sniffer dog, and it's calling for all ports of entry to have biosecurity measures boosted to try and prevent African swine fever from getting into Australia. Australian Pork's Margot Andre says the disease is spreading mostly because of human travel, and the lack of quarantine resources in some areas is concerning.
Yeah, look, I'm quite open, we are very anxious. This disease is spreading at a phenomenal rate, and there appears to be no barriers, and that's because it is carried by people. So people obviously have access to go anywhere at the moment, and they seem to be spreading the disease at a very rapid rate. So we are feeling very anxious.
So what is Australia's plan to stop it from getting into the country?
Yeah, so the simple fact is that it is carried by people, or if for some reason someone bought in a pig with the disease, but at the moment it is very much around people bringing it in, whether it's through smuggling in meat products in bags and packages, whether it's sending them through the mail, or whether it's on their clothing. They've returned from countries with ASF and they're not practicing good hygiene in terms of cleaning boots and clothes and things like that. So we've been working pretty closely with the government, federally and state, to ramp up the border security. So we're looking at all options.
In our coverage yesterday, a lot of people seem shocked to learn that the Darwin International Airport does not have a sniffer dog. What's your take on that?
So there's been a reduction in sniffer dogs over the past 10 years to quite low numbers. There's two reasons for this. One is that their dogs are no longer just trained for one thing. So we now see dogs that are trained for disease, drugs, you name it, horticulture. Seeing them trained. So the dogs are more multi-purpose, but there's also a push to rely on technology, x-rays, 3D scanners, things like that. I was pretty alarmed that there's nothing at Darwin. As you said, the amount of flights coming into Darwin, it's quite alarming. So we're going to probably ramp up even more that all ports should be protected. It's not just those that have pigs within the states in production, that feral pigs are just as dangerous.
So you'd like to see a sniffer dog at Darwin International Airport, though?
I'd like to see more than one.
Yep.
So we are working with the government. As I said, we do understand that they have made changes to the way the dogs operate, but we just don't want to be sitting here in 6 months' time saying we should have. We'd rather say let's just be preventative. We've managed to keep out the top 10 diseases out of Australia because of our strong biosecurity, and I do have to give accolades to those people working at the borders. They are trying their best, but the amount of things that are coming in and the fact that we cannot get the message through that people cannot bring products in and they have to clean their clothing and do not go on a piggery for at least 10 days if you have been in a country. We need people to listen and listen well or it will decimate our entire industry.
It's a big issue. That is Margot Andre, CEO of Australian Pork Limited, and speaking there to Matt Brann. It is after 12:30 on the Country Hour with the latest in news headlines. It's good afternoon to Lucy Robinson.
Good afternoon, Isabella. The police commissioner says a rise in complaints against police is due to a system change, not due to a change in police behaviour. The new scheme replaced the Office of the Police Ombudsman and saw a rise of about 1,000 complaints in its first year of operation. There'll be a review of the Police Complaints Act, including the system, in the coming months. Overseas in Papua New Guinea's west, New Britain province, agricultural land may be at risk and residents forced to evacuate their homes as an erupting volcano threatens villages. A series of small earthquakes were felt around the Mount Ulawan volcano on Monday before eruptions of steam and ash began this morning. Up to 12,000 people were displaced by eruptions from Ulawan in June, with many only recently returning to their homes. And back home, the Victorian government is responding to ransomware attacks on some of the state's largest health providers. Several services have been affected, including the operators of hospitals in Warrnambool, Colac, Geelong and Sale. Affected hospitals have had to temporarily shut down some of their patient booking and management systems to prevent further attacks. There'll be more ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Lucy. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to senior forecaster John Fisher.
Good afternoon, Isabella.
Now, it is warming up. It already feels quite warm today, and we're nowhere near that dreaded 40-degree mark.
Yeah, that's right. Certainly has been a change. The heat's certainly switched on now. So looking at today, we do have generally northerly winds across the state, fairly fresh across the west, and that's where the hottest temperatures are today. So getting up into the mid to high 30s out through the west coast there, currently around 33 at Ceduna, and we have fairly strong northerly winds out through there. So could see some raised dust about the west coast and northwest pastoral as well. Across the south, we will see some cloud building across Eyre Peninsula and the central districts later this afternoon and evening, and could see some thundery showers push across the kind of Gulf areas as we move through the evening, and then that area of cloud and possible thundery showers will push across the agricultural areas and eastern districts during Wednesday morning, but unfortunately not too much in the way of rainfall with that activity, maybe just up to a millimetre or so. Also at the surface, so we do have a trough in the west of the state, and that will be pushing across the west and south of the state during Wednesday. So temperatures will start to drop back across the western and southern coasts during Wednesday, remaining pretty warm ahead of that change, and fairly windy as well through central and eastern districts on Wednesday. Could see a little bit of raised dust east of the ranges there through the Riverland and far east and parts of the mid-north as well with those winds, and temperatures for tomorrow will remain fairly warm across the northern agricultural areas, getting up into the low 30s there again. So this trough which does come through is a fairly weak feature, that heat's going to remain in the north of the state. So as we move through the remainder of the week there for Thursday, look, generally dry conditions, maybe just a slight chance of a shower about the lower southeast coast in the onshore flow there, but really not much in the way of any rainfall. Looking at temperatures building a bit across the north, so getting up into the low 40s for the far west of the state, but generally, you know, mild to warm conditions across the south on Thursday. And that's also going to be another dry day there. So for Friday and into the weekend, though, we do see another more significant change begin to develop in the west of the state, moving across the state during Saturday. And it's with this change which we're going to see the hottest of the temperatures and the strongest of the winds across large parts of the state. So, yeah, starting on Friday there, look, maybe just some slight chance of the showers with some middle-level cloud over the lower southeast, but generally dry over the remainder, strengthening northern winds there. Could start to see some dust with those winds in the far west of the state, so Eyre Peninsula and the northwest pastoral, and very hot temperatures again. So another day of temperatures in the high 30s to low 40s for the north and west of the state, so quite unusual for this time of year. And those temperatures will be dragged across the remainder of the state ahead of that more significant trough coming through on Saturday there, and unfortunately it's going to be another fairly dry change apart from maybe it's just some showers about the lower southeast there, Isabella. So yeah, unfortunately it's another dry period, and looking at some potentially windy, dusty kind of conditions for Friday and Saturday there, before temperatures do come back a little bit behind that change for Sunday and into early next week, and maybe just some light showers about southern coasts, but nothing really too significant there, Isabella.
It is unfortunate, and I don't think many people are looking forward to it already being in the 40s in October.
It is a bit unusual. Some parts of the state could even see some early season record temperatures. And I should also just mention that today the Weather Bureau has resumed our heatwave service, so you can find that on our website. It is showing up a low intensity heatwave developing this week for the northwest pastoral with those really hot temperatures.
Alrighty, thanks for that, John. There you go, a heatwave warning already looking likely, and it's, what is it? It's the first week of October. That's scary. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now, and for the Upper Western District, a sunny day tomorrow with overnight temperatures falling to between 10 and 14 and daytime temperatures reaching around 30 degrees. And for the Lower Western District, a partly cloudy day with overnight temperatures falling to between 8 and 12 and daytime temperatures reaching the low 30s. We're off to the Space Forum next.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
It is 22 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Great to have your company this Tuesday. Well, some of Australia's brightest minds are in Adelaide today for the 8th Space Forum and the Australian Space Research Conference. While the emerging industry is looking to the stars, it also has a very practical benefit for farmers here on the ground on planet Earth. Marty McCarthy is at the conference to learn how. Marty, what's it like there today?
G'day, Isabella. I'm probably in a little bit over my head here with this crowd of engineers and physicists and avionics technicians and astrophysicists and the like. There's probably about 1,000 brainy delegates expected here over the course of the conference this week. Now, this young but booming industry, it has about 70 companies, institutions and government departments involved in South Australia in some way or another. So it's a pretty big deal here. And increasingly as well, Isabella, for the farm sector.
And lots of things to learn and insight to be gained. How could this space industry help farmers in the future?
Yeah, so as it develops, space-based technology will have massive applications for farmers, but also agronomists, food manufacturers even, environmental scientists, and of course, the lawmakers, policymakers, just to name a few. But it all comes down to remote sensing satellites that are probably the most significant development as far as agriculture is concerned, and then also environmental monitoring. But these are tiny satellites, some the size of shoeboxes, that can do anything from monitoring soil health, drought and crop growth and development, all from space. So some of the researchers and startups present here today are even trying to develop satellites and software that can detect crop diseases in paddocks from space, or growth deficiencies in particular plants and paddocks before those come to destroy a crop. So these satellites as well, pretty advanced stuff that companies are trying to develop. They can also detect rainfall and moisture in soil too, hyper-localise as well to individual paddocks and farms. So in the future, they could even help entire farming regions more accurately predict their crop forecasts and get a more accurate accurate data on that in advance. So that's what I'm here to learn about today, and I'll bring those stories to you in the coming days, Isabella.
We look forward to it. Thanks, Marty. That is Marty McCarthy, who is at the 8th Space Forum and also the Australian Space Research Conference. That's all happening together in Adelaide today. And as you heard, Marty also mentioned a little bit about satellites, and developing Australian satellite research into world-leading technology is one of the main goals for the new $110 million Smart Satellites Cooperative Research Centre. The SmartSat CRC will put together satellite research for agriculture, mining, transport, telecommunications and defence industries. CEO designate Professor Andy Coronius and is at the Space Forum in Adelaide today and says that it's important Australia develops its own technology to be competitive globally.
Well, Australia hasn't traditionally had a lot of satellite technologies of its own to task and control, and that means we are at a disadvantage because other countries are able to actually fly satellites over our country and take pictures, remote sensing and so on, and understand our land better than we can because we haven't been able to do that. So what the SmartSat CRC will do is it has brought together the best universities, the CSIRO as well as DST, working together with industry and funded by the federal government and industry to build new generation of satellite technologies that will really provide connectivity for Australia everywhere.
So what can agriculture get out of the SmartSat CRC?
Agriculture and farming is a very important sector for Australia. And today this activity is very much a science. And therefore, you'd rely very much on data. The data that you collect from, say, on-the-ground sensors can actually be fused with data that you take from satellite, Earth observation satellites, where you are actually able to see the land, to measure the ground cover, to see whether the moisture of the soil. All of that information can be brought together to allow the farmer to make far better decisions in reducing the risk and increasing profitability for his farm or her farm.
Are there security or privacy concerns, though, with all these smaller satellites now being easily accessed?
Well, in terms of privacy, of course, every technology is a double-edged sword. It could be used for good and it can be used for not so good, for evil. So definitely there are concerns. There are concerns about privacy is not obviously always, every time we collect data, we need to be very thoughtful and have some regulations about where the data is going. But a lot of that data and certainly the resolution, and particularly for agricultural, from the agricultural perspective, it would not be the most important of the issues. Because the resolution is not going to be such that you'll be able to identify the person, for instance, from a satellite, although that resolution is improving all the time. In terms of security, of course, and particularly with hostile nations and so on, that risk is always there. There are international regulations, of course, and there are mechanisms for us to protect the assets, the satellite assets that Australia will put up there in the same ways as other countries expect for their satellites not to be interfered with. But that risk is always there, as it is on the ground.
What makes you most excited about the SmartSat CRC for agriculture?
Well, first of all, I'm very excited because the SmartSat CRC will build sovereign technologies. It will build Australian technologies, and therefore those technologies will be used to transform the Australian industry and therefore make agriculture and mining, but agriculture in particular, make it more competitive overseas. Yeah, at the moment, other countries have access, as I said, every day, hundreds of satellites pass over Australia. They take pictures of the farms. They take thermal sensing and hyperspectral imagery that then allows them to get a better understanding of the farmer's crop than the farmer knows themselves now. And therefore, they have the advantage. Because if other countries can actually know what your yield is going to be before you do, then when you're negotiating, you're at a disadvantage. So what makes us excited is to provide that capability for Australia and therefore to build our own industry, therefore more jobs and better economy for Australia, but also enhance and transform agriculture for us.
Australia hasn't been a big player in the space race until now. How will we go about catching up?
That is a great question, and in some areas it's very difficult to catch up. But actually what we have done is we have looked at the areas that provide the most value. And the most value is around, and that's why we called it the SmartSat CRC, is around the smarts of the satellite, not as much the building of large satellites and so on, not even as much as in the launching of satellites, because other countries can do it better and cheaper. We focused on the intelligence area and as well as the communications. We focused on that because, A, Australia has some really good core capability in artificial intelligence as well as in advanced communications, and also because that's where the biggest opportunities are for actual greater jobs and exports for us.
That's SmartSat Cooperative Research Centre CEO-designate Professor Andy Koronius speaking there to Cassie Huff. And the SmartSat CRC is funded both by industry and the government. While we are talking about ag tech, there is a lot of work going on in this space. So Meat and Livestock Australia decided to put as much livestock technology to the test. They installed every bit of technology they could find on the one farm in Coolah near Canberra to see what works and what doesn't. Head of Innovation Sean Starling started this project out of frustration, but it's now delivering results. He chatted to rural reporter Hugh Hogan.
So our hyperconnected farm, which Coolah Pastoral Company has graciously hosted that with us, and we've all learnt a lot, we've learnt some things not to do and some things to do, is we approached them approximately 12 months ago and explained our frustration with where we thought there was some claims in the media or on websites about what was ready for the livestock sector and what wasn't. They were frustrated, being the general manager, Darren Price, of Coolah, and we were frustrated that we were hearing a lot of noise all about what was out there, how it was going to benefit our industry. We weren't seeing a lot of it being deployed on property. So Coolah gave us the luxury or the opportunity to use their property base to install as many different widgets that we could find. What was really interesting for us as an organisation, Meat and Livestock Australia, is we found 150 global and domestic solution providers who either claimed on their website or had put in media that they had a solution. When we reached out to those 150, 20 turned up. And of those 20 that turned up, I think we've got about 15 left. So five we've just got rid of because they just weren't fit for purpose.
That's a very high attrition rate. So of those, what, you got 15 high-tech innovations on the farm. Talk us through it.
Yeah, so the high-tech innovations in some ways have been great that we've got them. but in other ways they're far from completed our shopping list. So the types of technologies we've got on farm now are, and they don't sound like rocket science, but they are adding value: water tank sensors, water trough sensors, gate sensors, weather stations, rain gauges, some animal tracking, diesel tank monitoring. So some of that technology, it might not sound like rocket science, but at least we've now been able to prove you can buy it, you can install it, you can get some value from it. We're still well short of the mark, and I'm not saying it's not out there, but it's not out there in a big way. We're well short of the mark of lots and lots of different providers in the animal tag market. Walkover Wayne, that's fit for purpose everywhere, and virtual fencing. Now, all of this is coming, but we still don't have it deployed at Carwoolie yet.
You say in the future, you're also working on an augmented reality project. Talk us through that. You sort of pick your phone up and point at a water trough, and it'll tell you how much water's in there and...
Yeah, so we didn't think we were pushing the boundaries just quite enough, which is some of those sensors we mentioned. We thought we should up the ante a lot more, and augmented and virtual reality is one of those things that we're all hearing about now. So we wanted to understand, is there a connection here or a value proposition that augmented and or virtual reality can deliver for us on property? And the first experiment that we've tried, and at the moment it's working quite well, it's got a long way to go, is instead of using your phone app and dial and looking through lots of different apps on your phone, depending on what solution provider you use to look at a water tank level, you can now get out of your four-wheel drive, you can hold your iPad up, you can point it over at a series of tanks or troughs or dams, and the information from those devices now just appear on your screen.
It's almost simplifying the tech that's already out there, making it a bit more palatable for the farmers.
Correct. It's trying to make sure that you can get out of your truck, or you don't even have to get out of your truck, you can just hold your iPad up and it gives you the sense of the field sensor recordings there without having to get your iPhone out and scroll through multiple screens.
Where are we with drones at the moment? We hear so much about it.
Yeah, so drones, I'll give you a two-part response. So without doubt, drones have an application to private producers and growers now. I think most private producers and growers should have it for their own peace of mind. If there's a problem, as long as they're in line of sight, they can pop it up and they can have a look. So we think that's fantastic, but that's not the work that MLA is supporting, because for me that's not really an R&D, a big innovative question. What we think we need to work on, and we are working on, both in aerial and ground solutions, is fully autonomous services. So this is a concept where a drone, either aerial or ground, following the right procedures and rules and practices, so we're not trying to bypass any CASA rules and regulations, is that it's getting on and doing its job for you. And the only time you know it's there is it sends you an alert to say, I've seen something that you as a producer need to make a call on. So an example is you're in a paddock. The drone knows that you're there because it's talking to your phone, so it knows your location. It says to you, hey, would you like me to go and look at counting the number of animals in your paddock or looking at the number of weeds you've got? You as a producer become the eyes and ears for it. You acknowledge that. The drone pops out of its box, goes and does this activity, and you get a report at the end that says this is how many adult cattle you've got or how many calves you've got, or this is how your weed population is growing, as an output, as a simple number. You don't have to look through 3 hours or 2 hours or 1 hour of video and do that analysis yourself.
That's Sean Starling, the General Manager of Innovation at Meat and Livestock Australia. And also, it's the next generation that are getting in on the ag tech action as well. Tools to help farmers know when troughs are leaking, farm apps, smart farm watches, and even magnetic dog leads are some of the ideas that have come from the Cleve Area School AgriFutures pitches. The presentations were part of the AgriFutures program, which is being run at schools across the country, encouraging agricultural-based entrepreneurship. Cleve Area School is the only South Australian school that has been chosen to take part this year. Brooke Neindorf went along to help judge the pitches and caught up with ag teacher Annie Richter about the program.
So we are involved in Ag Futures competition, where the Year 8s and 9s, as part of agriculture and also English, have found a problem in agriculture or in the community, and have come up with a solution, an innovative solution, and they've also pitched their idea to judges that have come in today. And they had to do lots of research, survey community members and experts in the field to get feedback and then tweak their idea.
What have been some of the ideas that have really impressed you?
One of the Year 9s, one of the winners from the Year 9s was about, they looked at websites, a website and an app to really about awareness of issues with farmers and how farmers can be connected to help each other out pretty well.
How impressed have you been with the ideas that the students have come up with? Because I know as a judge myself, I was very impressed with them thinking of the problem that farmers might have but then coming up with a solution.
Oh, they've been amazing because, yeah, it's been really difficult because not all of them are, you know, farmers or come from a farming background. So, yeah, it's been quite tricky. So some of them just really went out of their way and rang up people and talked to community members about different ideas. So they really use their resources, which has been really good.
How many have you had actually going and testing out prototypes and making things and designing things here at the school?
Yeah, well, we've had a couple come to me this week wanting to go into the tech building to make some stuff, which has been really good. And a couple have just done some models out of cardboard. But, yeah, so we haven't really got that far down the track yet. But I'm sure if they win, they will do some more work there.
So the Year 8 winners from today and the Year 9 winners from the other week, they go up against each other now. Then they are winners chosen out of those groups. They then go on to Sydney, is that right?
That's right. So, yeah. So they'll both compete and we'll get in another few judges. And then that winner will, go to Sydney very soon. And I guess if they get some more feedback, they can still change or adapt anything to make it better because they'll be competing really against other states. So, yeah.
What's the prize?
I'm not actually sure yet. I think there is money involved, which will go back to, I think it might be for the school or for their idea to put it into action. So, yeah, we haven't been told yet, but there is money involved. So,
well, I'm here with the winning team, the two Georges. Congratulations, girls, on going through today as the Year 8 winners. Where did your idea come from?
It just came around from George's family and generation and thought it'd be a good idea to try to get it up and running.
Well, Georgia, other Georgia, do you want to explain to me what your idea actually was?
Yeah, so our idea is a sensor on troughs to detect when the water levels are really low and when it hasn't had water for quite some time. And it will alert you on an app that tells you that the water trough is low and have multiple sensors on different troughs.
Did it take you long to come up with that idea?
Yeah, it took us a while. I had a few chats to my dad and my dad had some friends over and we just had a bit of a chat about it and they helped contribute to our idea.
And now you will present again. Have you got any ideas about how you might improve your presentation again or maybe something you might add to the idea of the handy trough?
Yeah, well, we've got some ideas and feedback, which is adding in some like water leaks and if there's like bird poo,
Yep, and one of the judges suggested that when the water trough doesn't have any water, that there's actually a switch that fills the water back up. So that would save farmers more time.
And do you think it's an idea, if you keep going further, that potentially you could go ahead? Or even if you don't win in the next few months, that something that you could maybe potentially look at investing in?
Yeah, I think it's actually it's like saves lives, so it's very important. So, and one of our feedback from our survey said that it'd be really important on stations and stuff because there's like large acres of area, and then just who help them.
More evidence that the future is in safe hands. That's Georgia and Georgia, who are in Year 8 at Cleve Area School, and they were the winners in their class of the Agri-Futures Pitches and were speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. And in news just in, South Australian River Murray Irrigators, their water allocation has increased to 87%. That is up from 81% announced on September 16th and edging closer to full allocations there. Let's head to the markets now, and John Traeger has the results from the Dublin sheep sale.
Good afternoon. Quality was fair to good and numbers remained similar as agents offered 9,000 lambs and 3,000 sheep to the usual trade and processor buyers, especially butchers, and another good field of restockers. Competition was good as buyers appeared more focused on securing numbers, with early sales up by $15 to $20 per head across all weights and grades. However, later sales sold firm to $10 dearer than the previous sale, with restockers more active on lighter weight crossbred merino lambs. And other good yardage of mostly heavier weight mutton sold firm, with rams also selling to a firm trend. Extremely light young lambs sold mainly to restockers from $74 to $104, with lightweights to the trade ranging from $87 to $138. Light trade types sold from $130 to $158, medium weights received $138 to $160, with heavy weights trading from $190 to $238 per head. Fewer older lambs came forward, with lightweights selling from $110 to $146. Medium weights received $142 to $170, as heavier weights range from $182 to $238 per head. Hoggets also lifted in price under steady competition, with lighter weights selling from $80 to $112, with heavyweights receiving $140 to $184. Light ewe mutton ranged from $80 to $115, with heavyweights receiving $130 to $165 per head, with a small selection of wethers ranging from $125 to $148. Rams sold from $100 to $158 per head. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. And that's, really nearly all the time we've got left on the Country Hour. Head to abc.net.au/rural for more stories from across the country. Right now, though, it's heading up to 1 o'clock. News time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.